You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Did you know that some of our break music comes from independent musicians? Maybe you'll be one of them. Find more information at thetakeaway.org/music.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Oh, who doesn't love listening to that? Later this hour, harmonica love, as we remember the legendary Larry Adler. We'll also explore the vampire-werewolf love of paranormal erotic fiction, something for Valentine's Day. Hey, that genre sells way more than Tom Friedman or crime novels. And I just have to say personally that I love the fact, please indulge me here, that the Lego movie blew out the box office this weekend with a take of nearly $70 million. Okay, who cares? But this was beyond product placement, beyond toy stories. This was a celebration of creativity and design and, okay, little pieces of plastic that have screwed up vacuum cleaners for decades and made people scream walking to the bathroom barefoot in the dark at night who step on one of those Lego pieces. Ouch, that hurts. But that Legos have a blockbuster movie and that America came along for the ride, that says something to me great about design and building stuff and dreaming. We got a good future ahead of us, America. Whatever. I just had to get that off my chest. But what I don't have to get off my chest is $900 million, or $3.3 billion. Now, we begin this hour with the list the Chronicle of Philanthropy has released of the top 50 most generous donors in 2013. On top, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and his wife, Priscilla Chen, who managed to unseat last year's number one, Warren Buffett. Most of Zuckerberg's money went to community foundations and American education. Investor Buffett has said for a long time that there is a core value to giving that goes with his view of capitalism.
Basically, most of the rich people in the United States, I mean, they would not have done quite as well if they'd been in Bangladesh or someplace like that. I mean, they may think they did it all by themselves, but the society has done an awfully lot for them. And if you get the chance to live very rich in the society, you really ought to, in my view, you ought to have a taxation system, but you also ought to have a personal value system where you believe that a lot of that ought to go back to the people that got the short straws in life.
Giving back, either through taxation, through philanthropy, it's a core value for Buffett. And the philanthropy list also noted donors who gave their money to international aid and development.
In Africa, there's no confusion that things have gotten better over the last 40 years. You know, they have many of the fastest growing economies in the world. As you go up the income ladder, the ability to build stable governments and get the investment and education right, that's always an uncertain process. But we know that as you do get richer, stability, rights, all the things that we care about come into play. And eventually, there's a level of human dignity that we think of as universal.
Is it that way? Is that exactly the impact that Bill and Melinda Gates have had? That's, of course, Bill Gates speaking on our program a month ago. And oddly, Bill and Melinda Gates were left off the list for technical reasons, partly because a $3.3 billion donation started their foundation back in 2004. And as you can hear there, Bill Gates certainly believes that things have changed for the better in Africa and the other places where he has invested. But do we value philanthropy in this country correctly? Do we get it right? And most importantly, do the billionaires who donate, who become part of this top 50 list, do they get it right? William Easterly is a professor of economics at New York University and author of the upcoming book, The Tyranny of Experts. He spent his career thinking about these issues. He's right here in the studio today. Welcome.
Thank you.
So do we get it right? Do we value philanthropy right when we make top 10 lists like this? Are we celebrating the right people here, in your view?
Well, I have nothing to take away from the billionaires who are very generous, who are spending on the poor rather than on private jets. That's great. But what can actually happen is they can also have too much influence on the way we see the whole problem of global poverty. And I think Gates himself, I'm afraid, has been kind of a bad example in this regard.
Well, let's explore Gates then for a moment. Why do you think he's a bad example? We questioned him about certain choices that he made, his choices to work with particular governments in Africa, the kinds of things that he has to sort of look the other way on if he wants to have an influence on the population.
Yeah, Gates has this sort of great man approach to development in which he sees kind of great national leaders and great philanthropists like himself doing all the good things that happen. Unfortunately, the Ethiopian government, for example, that he praised a year ago in his annual letter from his foundation, is not doing great things. So he's very naive to think that such a government is benevolent and is actually contributing to development. They actually are serial or human rights abusers that are destroying development.
And there's no political freedom, at least not anything that we would regard as traditional political freedom in Ethiopia.
Yeah, and this, definitely not. I mean, before Gates' annual letter, just a couple of months before, there was a peaceful blogger named Iskender Nega who was sentenced to 18 years in prison simply for advocating more democracy in Ethiopia, for writing about the Arab Democratic Spring. And, you know, this kind of democratic activism is what you need to make government leaders benevolent. I mean, if you think of our own sort of Chris Christie scandal on the bridge, you know, that's the sign of democracy working, that we keep Chris Christie from doing something bad. He'll never do it again. No other governor will ever do it again.
Although the counterargument there is, why does democracy have to precede people getting food if they're starving?
I don't think we have any evidence that one precedes the other. I think they go together. You know, as rights expand, people are able to stop their government from doing really bad things to them. For example, in Ethiopia, one of the things that the government did, the same government that Gates was praising, is they had a project in the Gambela region in southern Ethiopia where they forced farmers off their lands at gunpoint. They seized the farmers' lands. They sold them to foreign companies, which enriched the government's coffers. And they marched the farmers away to these top-down government-created model villages, so-called model villages, that didn't even have basic services like clean drinking water. Now, that's the kind of thing that will happen with even at very poor societies if you don't have enough democratic rights. If you put people like Iskender Nega in jail and don't allow people to protest the government doing bad things, that's the kind of thing that happens. And that's undeveloping Ethiopia. The government Gates is praising is undeveloping Ethiopia. It's not developing Ethiopia.
And we should note that Gates has made investments all over Africa, not just in Ethiopia.
Sure,
but let's look close to home here. Zuckerberg was honored for community foundations and for helping educational institutions. Do you think the Zuckerbergs of the world are the main impetus in domestic philanthropy, or is it the small donors, the sort of culture of giving that has more impact, small people who aren't going to be recognized on this list?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of small donations, and I think the small donors are more likely to get it right. They are not as seduced by this sort of great man vanity where, you know, people like Gates see themselves as one of the heroes of development, whereas small donors don't, perhaps not so seduced by that delusion.
Do you think billionaires tend to compete with each other? Bloomberg, Buffett, you mentioned Gates, Zuckerberg, whereas the smaller donors are maybe much more focused on outcomes in their own community because they're stakeholders?
Sure. I mean, for example, progress on public health in this country was made a lot by small donors and philanthropists like the philanthropists who founded what is now Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, were a big part of the reduction in child mortality in New York. Also, of course, democratic activism is a big part of the story in the health triumphs in New York.
Although the counterargument there is, you know, you have the philanthropy of the Gilded Age as having left a real tangible legacy, which I don't necessarily see in some of this giving that is on this list. Carnegie, for instance, there's a library in every community because of what Andrew Carnegie thought about education and democratic values in creating public libraries. The Rockefellers, for all of the horrors they committed as capitalists and in developing the oil industry, whatever you want to say, and we don't want to argue about that, certainly created the infrastructure for medical research in the United States that did not exist before the Rockefellers began giving. Do you see current giving leaving tangible results like we had 100 years ago?
Well, it doesn't really matter whether the results are tangible. It's whether they get the job done. I think the problem with Gates is he's really selling the wrong approach to development. And there are other billionaires that are getting it right. I mean, George Soros is on the list. His Open Society Foundation is one of the funders of Human Rights Watch. that has exposed some of the abuses of the Ethiopian government that are helping the development of Ethiopia by helping point out these abuses.
Can't you make an argument that you want to be separate from politics? The United Nations and many NGOs try to stay out of politics. CARE, for instance, and the Red Cross are completely independent of politics. CARE and the Red Cross go into Ethiopia regardless of what the government is doing and get access because of their objectivity or their their detachment from politics.
Well, that's the perpetual temptation in poverty reduction, to think you can do something that's technically pure, that's free from politics. But unfortunately, that's a delusion. I mean, let me give you one example of that. The famine relief, you might think, is as apolitical as it can get. But unfortunately, to go back to Ethiopia, the same government that Gates was praising was caught red-handed using famine relief to only give it to supporters of the ruling party. They denied it to the opposition party members. They were starving the opposition from even, in the middle of a famine, they were rewarding their own supporters and staying in power by that means.
What do you make of sustainable outcomes as an approach to social entrepreneurship, the strategy that Gates helped to develop and has been picked up by people like the Skoll Foundation?
Sustainable is one of these very vague words in development that we often use to disguise the fact that we are really not honest about the kind of things we've been talking about here today. Sustainable is just this vague feel-good word. We really need to be much more precise, talk about, are you promoting rights for the poor that are both an end in themselves and that also help make development happen?
William Easterly is a professor of economics at New York University and author of the upcoming book, The Tyranny of Experts. Professor, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Lots of Olympics over the weekend, but did anyone on NBC mention physics? No, 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 no. That's where we come in our series on the science of the Winter Olympic sports, from skeleton to skiing. How do they do that? Some answers are simple, some complex, like the part sport, part ritual of curling. Hey, have you got a fave?
Hi, I'm Chris from Philadelphia. My favorite sport, it's the luge. There's nothing more extreme to watch.
I agree. Dean Martinez from Roy, Utah. I love the intense competition, women's figure skating, the strength, focus, determination required to win. One of you in Rockville, South Carolina says, I usually love the figure skating, but this year the United States Olympic Committee bumped a young lady who skated clean for one, who fell twice in qualifying. That, of course, is a controversy much discussed by the NBC commentators.
Hi, my name is Shanna, and I'm from Granite City, Illinois. My favorite winter sport to watch is probably figure skating, because my mom and my aunt would call each other on the phone while they would watch. And now that my aunt has passed away, it's difficult for us to watch. But when we do, it brings back fond memories of them being on the phone together and making better commentary than the television commentators.
Well, I have more on the Olympics, the physics of the Olympics, in a moment. But first, a special takeaway invitation. If you're in New York this week, we've lined up an evening for anyone who loves codes and code breakings and codes that are critical in our understanding of science. Great guests, amazing stories at WNYC in the Green Space in Manhattan tomorrow. Much more at thetakeaway.org, including how you can get a ticket. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
Lots to watch over the weekend as the Olympics got underway. Finally, Russia and the U.S. getting gold medals. Russia seeming to dominate skating in the early going, while the U.S. dominating men's and women's snowboarding so far. Much more to come in the Sochi Games, and we wanted to pose the question, how do they do that? The Winter Olympics is a spectacular combination of low-temperature chemistry and physics, athletics, of course, pure guts, and absolute beauty and grace. But physics rule.
The laws of physics constrain all of us. There's only so high, any one of us could jump or how fast we could go down a hill. And to see athletes using technology, using advanced training methods and diets and nutrition, and getting just to the envelope of what's theoretically possible is just a fantastic achievement. As a scientist, it's just phenomenal to see that in play.
That's Eric Goff, our resident Olympics physicist and the voice of our series, How Do They Do That? He's the chair of the physics department at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports. And today we begin with curling. It's got two teams, four players each, facing off, sliding their smooth stones across a sheet of ice. The object of the game is to get your stone as close to a circular target on the ice called the house. The curler shoots the stone. Two sweepers literally sweep the ice with special brooms and guide the stone while screaming commands to each other. But under that sliding stone, it's all physics.
What's prepared ahead of time is that they will spray some water on an icy surface, liquid water, and when it freezes, it'll be into little textured surfaces so that the ice isn't completely smooth. And that actually helps reduce the friction as the rock is sliding along the ice, because the rock can't make complete contact with the ice. There's not like a vacuum seal that's going on. And after the person will push off the hack and get the rock going, then you have a couple of sweepers ahead of the rock, and they will vigorously be sweeping. And they can actually melt a little water layer, and that helps lower the friction as the rock gets on top of it. They will also spin, sometimes one to, say, four revolutions. You'll see the stone spinning on the way down. They can actually get it to curl with the help of the brooming, so they can knock the opponent's stones out of the house that way.
And that's what makes it curling. Science has to be in harmony with strategy in this game. Curling is all about brains as well as melting points and pure brawn.
Some people refer to it as like chess on ice, and the idea is, once all of these stones start accumulating in the house, you can knock your opponent's stones out. So you want to get your stones in to maximize your point total and also knock your opponents out. So with just the right amount of broom work and just the right spin and just the right release speed, that stone can come in. Perhaps we've seen knocking two or more of the opponent's stones out.
So forget all the physics. Anyone who does curling, really does curling, knows that it's really a mind game all the way around, through and through. Brady Clark, is that the case?
Yeah, that's definitely the case, John. You know, I would also add that it takes a lot of teamwork, passion, practice, and there's a whole physical and mental side of the game, as well as strategy.
And Brady Clark, of course, is the reigning national curling champion. What is it that you do psychologically to prepare for a curling? Is it a match? Is it a game? What do you call it?
You know, typically it's called a game, and mental preparation requires visualization and being able to perform under pressure.
And it seems to me that in curling, there's less of a concern about equipment than a lot of the other sports where there's equipment obsessions, and much more of a concern about strategy and signaling between team members and really, you know, how you kind of psych out the other team.
Yeah, you know, curling, definitely there is some key equipment. It's not as extensive as a lot of other sports, but those four team members have to all be working collaboratively and communicating. It takes four members of every team to make a shot.
Brady, I want to be a world-class sweeper. What do I need in my gut?
You need drive, and you need passion, and be working out not with just your upper body, but you need to be working out your whole body. Big arms certainly are a huge aspect, but you also need a strong lower body.
Now, do you have names for the stone? Do you, you know, kiss it goodbye when you send it off there down the ice? What goes through your mind when you fire away?
You know, I would compare it a lot to golf. And before every shot, you've got a little routine that you do. You know what your objective is for that shot. You know how hard you have to throw it. And you've got a line of delivery that you're trying to deliver that stone. You're also talking with your teammates about what you're aiming to do and what you're looking for them to do. So there's a lot of aspects in the sport. Just like golf, you've got a little bit of downtime before you're about to throw your stone. So you've got a lot of thoughts in your mind. You have to control it. And then you need to be able to slide out in a smooth, consistent way and deliver that stone on the target. And then rely on your teammates to do the rest.
What can you do in curling that would never be permitted on the golf course?
I would say you can yell at your teammates. You know, your teammates learn how to read your signals and how you're yelling and what that means. So a lot of people watch the sport and they say, what's all this yelling about? You're communicating. But when there's three or four other games going on out there, it can be very difficult to hear your teammates, and you're trying to relay information to them, and they're relaying the information back to the rest of the team as well, because the sweepers play an integral role on every shot.
And when it doesn't work out, is it all your fault, or is it just bad breaks, bad luck?
Well, at this level, I like to take ownership for every game. There's always shots that you could have made, but at the end of the day, you have to be able to reset and move on and go back to the training program and figure out what you can improve upon to be the best in the world.
And when your team is like in the huddle there before the gold medal round, do you spend a lot of time talking about, remember, guys, it's the water molecules that are going from a solid state to a liquid state, and we got to get them on our side. You talk a lot about molecules and physics and stuff like that.
You know, we do keep in mind, though, what's going on with the ice conditions, because they do change as you're sweeping the ice, and over the course of a game, the ice conditions are changing. So we actually do talk about that. We just maybe don't get down to the molecular level.
Well, Brady Clark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you'll be watching in Sochi, right?
I will definitely be watching. I will be cheering on our U.S. team and hoping for them to medal.
Brady Clark is the reigning national curling champion.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
So on this question of how do they do that, let's take speed skating at the Olympics. Monster muscles, sleek near frictionless suits, and long bladed skates. But there's one more ingredient. The ice. We asked our friends at PRI Science Friday to explain how the ice in the Olympic arena is maybe not the same ice that cools your tall glass of lemonade. Joining us is Christopher Intagliata, senior producer for Science Friday. Welcome.
Hi, John.
Nice so I can't use this arena ice for any other purpose than speed skating, right?
Only for skating. You're not allowed to use it for anything else.
And in investigating this, you really have a sense of precision. Mark Norman, who's vice president of venues and sport at the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, someone with experience about this, talks about just how precise the speed skating conditions have to be.
To give you an example, so our 500 meter, our shortest distance, we tend to shoot for a surface temperature of the oval of about -8 Celsius. 1,000 meter, maybe -8.5. 1,500 meter, -9.5. 3K, 5K, 10K, -12.
Optimal temperatures for each race.
Exactly. And he's checking all this on his iPad during events down to the tenth of a degree. And the reason that actually matters is because for a long track, you want a little bit of a harder ice. For the short track, they're doing so much scrambling and fighting to get the lead. You want something that has a little bit more give. And that's why you have -8 Celsius versus -12.
How did he figure this stuff out?
Trial and error. He does a lot of experimenting in the arena. He also experiments with the air temperature. That's something else that we talked about.
And here's one of the ways in which he experiments with Olympic ice.
Well, it's a little bit less dense the warmer it gets, so it's a little bit easier to move through. I brought the building one day up to 72 during a competition. To me, that is where the optimal lies, but the athletes all hated it. It's just too hot. We're sweating. I got these skin suits on. We can't breathe.
And from the perspective of the skaters, they can feel the difference on the ice, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We talked with one speed skater there, Travis Janer, and he gave us his skater's perspective.
There are days where it feels like the ice is awful, and we're like, oh, what's going on? Like, I wonder if they're playing with it, or did the coaches ask them to do it on purpose? Or then you start asking, is it just me, or is it my blades? Like, did I lose, you know, are my blades dull? Or you're always fighting your own demons all the time, and yeah, the ice is a big part of it, but also it's, you know, something that should go unnoticed at the same time.
And this is much more down to the molecular level than, say, you know, juicing the ball in baseball or, you know, putting gook on the bat, you know, to increase the ability to hit. I mean, these are really, really tight tolerances.
Yeah, and I mean, there's weird physics stuff going on at the surface of the ice, and that's not something that Mark gets into. You know, he's not a physicist, But he has, through trial and error and being a former speed skater himself, really honed this down to the perfect combination of what skaters can do and what ice can do. Because in the end, if he makes ice that's too fast, they're falling all over themselves and they don't push their hardest.
And part of the issue is, and you alluded to this a moment ago, is that you need to be able to be almost frictionless when you're speeding. But you also need to get traction when you're trying to accelerate or make it through the curves. That's an interesting tension.
Exactly. And he uses purified water for the long track and the short track. But for the short track, he actually adds in a little city water, just like 1% or something, just to give a little minerals and dirt in there, just to give them a little bit more drag and so they can really push on the ice.
Scientifically, would we expect that the Russians have some, they're doing pretty well in skating so far, have some special ice formula?
I don't know. I don't know about the Russian formulas, but I will say that the guy who took the gold, Sven Kramer, in the 5K this weekend, he actually went 7 seconds slower than his record. And his record was set in Calgary, which is another really high elevation arena, just like Salt Lake City. So Salt Lake City and Calgary sort of vie for the title of fastest ice on Earth.
Christopher Intagliata is a senior producer for PRI's Science Friday. Thanks so much, Christopher.
Thank you.
The brutality of the Syrian civil war is the backdrop for peace talks that are trying to envision a political solution in Syria, even after hundreds of people were evacuated over the weekend from the besieged city of Homs under fire. All told, 100,000 dead, 9.5 million displaced. The first round of peace talks ended last month with no firm agreements and with both sides trading insults. As the second round of peace talks between the Syrian government and the opposition begins in Geneva, joining us on the line is Lara Satrakian, founder of Syria Deeply. Lara, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Is there any way to even envision a political settlement at this stage of the game? It seems to me there are two parallel realities here.
There are, in fact, several parallel realities. Even if you watch just the Geneva peace talks, you've got the negotiating table, the regime and the opposition barely making progress in the last round of talks, basically taking a week off and then coming back to the table today on Monday. And then you see a parallel track of the U.S. and Russia holding their own conversations. The U.S. and Russia are officially sponsoring the Geneva peace process, in theory pressuring both sides to make concessions to move the political process forward. But you see a stalemate at the U.S.-Russian level that's reflected in those Geneva talks. That's why, in a sense, you're really seeing a stalemate both on the ground and in the negotiations. That gets more complicated when you try to mix in implementing a ceasefire, delivering humanitarian aid. To make those kinds of moves, you need broad political agreement. But you can't get that agreement when the conditions on the ground are so bad.
And even what seemed as though international influence in Syria, the whole question of chemical weapons, that is stalled. The movement of chemical weapons seems to be delayed at best, if not completely shut down. So any influence the international community has here is dubious in the best case scenario.
Indeed. We heard from U.S. officials that less than 5% of Syria's chemical stockpile has actually left the country when the deadline to get all of it out was December 31st. So falling behind on that deal to remove chemical weapons from Syria, at the same time, that deal actually boosted the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. We also hear U.S. officials, and just clearly from what we're watching on the ground, that chemical weapons deal made it much easier for the Assad regime to gain ground, primarily because it removed the credible threat from the U.S. of any kind of use of force, any accountability against the Assad regime for its actions, for how it has in many ways really sparked this spiral of violence. It's not just any a question of the regime versus the rebels. It's utter chaos in terms of splinter groups among the rebels, extremist groups among the rebels, extreme jihadi ideology.
What's the net effect of that? Because it seems to me in this chaos, Assad has declared a certain kind of victory in that he's holding on. And the most extreme Islamist groups have also claimed a kind of victory in that they seem to be able to wave this flag of an Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, if not credibly to al-Qaeda, certainly credibly to the people inside Syria who are scared to death of them.
you're pointing to a reality of competing narratives, and everyone is winning in their version of this war. Assad himself, analysts say, has become basically a glorified mayor of Damascus. He controls the capital city, he controls swaths of territory, Alawite heavy areas, and some cities, urban areas in the north of the country. But then you do have broad areas of rebel control and pockets of extremist control, to the point where the talk now, especially in Arabic and especially on social media, is around emirates, actual Islamist emirates in Syria, tied to emirates in Iraq, actually Sunni areas in both countries that have really become extremist strongholds, where those flags fly and where they do declare victory and they do declare a certain degree of autonomy. You also see the Kurds in their own areas in the northeastern parts of the country declaring less victory and more autonomy. And now people talk about a future federalist Syria where all of these different pockets come together down the line, but that's going to take a lot of progress in just stabilizing the different pictures that are emerging.
You're talking about trends that advocate towards a de facto partition of Syria, yet in Geneva they're still talking as though Syria is one nation under one flag, and that's perhaps the least credible reality at this point of all. Lara Satrakian, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
Lara Satrakian is founder of Syria Deeply, speaking to us from Dubai.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
There's virtuoso crazy. John Popper from Blues Traveler. Then there's pop folk legend decent. Dylan, and then there's the real deal, Larry Adler. The one-of-a-kind true virtuoso of the harmonica, as comfortable in front of an orchestra as he was in front of a campfire. Today, it's 100 years since the birth of the man who forever changed the harmonica, Larry Adler, who died in 2001. Adler was a precocious musician from the start. $7 and a harmonica brought him to New York at age 14. He eventually enrolled in the Peabody Conservatory of Music, but was expelled soon after for being incorrigible. He extolled the virtues of being a lonely individualist, but he is the patron saint of the harmonica, elevating it from toy to concert solo instrument. Robert Bonfilio learned from the master, who was also his friend. We asked him to stop by to mark Larry Adler's 100th birthday. Robert, welcome.
That's great to be here.
It's great for a lot of reasons. I mean, Adler is to the harmonica what Earl Scruggs is to the banjo, in many ways what Les Paul is to the solid body electric guitar. Took an instrument, really created the sense of how it could be more than just a bit of decoration.
Well, actually, I would think more like Segovia, you know, maybe, because he had major works written for him for a harmonic and orchestra. And that's truly my connection to Adler, because before he died, he was the only other person I could talk to that was doing what I was doing, which is basically playing the major works for harmonic and orchestra with orchestras all over the world.
How did composers approach the harmonica?
Well, it's like every other instrument. Generally, you work with a virtuoso player. The harmonica is capable of amazing amounts of sounds.
Give me a little tour.
Oh, yeah. The first one, concerto, that was written was the Mio. And then after he had been blackballed by the House on American Activities Committee, he moved to England. And then we started with English composers. Vaughan Williams wrote a romance for him. And then Vaughan Williams had Arthur Benjamin write a harmonica concerto for him. And then after that, it just went on and on.
Well, we have a recording of Larry Adler playing the Benjamin concerto. Let's listen to that. Thank you. That's amazing. The dynamics, the articulation. Was he mic'd when he played that, or was he just standing there in front of the
orchestra? Most of the players played mic'd. Now it's gotten to be where there have been times where I've actually played without a microphone. And also instruments have just gotten to be better since he first started, the Hohner instruments.
As a friend of Larry Adler's, did he think of himself as a Paganini, as a Franz Liszt of his instrument, as a one-of-a-kind?
Well, both ways. You see, he was also friends with people like George and Ira Gershwin. So, you know, when you think of Adler, he used to say, I'm going to play this concerto, but I have to go down to the saloon tonight, you know, and
Summertime, no summertime right
no
now.
No summertime right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly. So there was a real intersection for him between pop music, folk music, and the classical pieces that he did.
Yes. In America, you have to think of the harmonica as being kind of America's instrument. You know, you think of freight trains and, you know, the cowboys and campfires, and Abraham Lincoln played the harmonica. So here we have a cross-section of being a folk instrument. And then at the same time was taken seriously when he had major composers write for it.
And this is an instrument that was solidly popular in the jazz age. Listen to this. Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Lady.
Yes, Barry. He always would play American music the same time.
You know, it feels more, I don't know, warm than a clarinet. You can hear, you know, the clarinet qualities of the harmonica.
But one of the things that's interesting is it's the closest instrument you play to your brain. You know, it's right in your mouth. It's cupped by your hands. And you can imagine if you could cup a piano in your hands, what kind of sounds you can get out of it. All the wah-wah kind of sound, bends, everything that you can do. And you make these sounds with your breath control. It is so personal. And you think of it as being somebody that's out in the middle of nowhere, lonely, all that has an eerie sound. But all instruments, they come from folk and they have connotations. Mm-hmm. And the connotations are, you know, simple. You know, they say the flute, oh, it's birds, you know, the horn, well, it's hunting, you know, and that's where they started.
Right.
And the harmonica was a portable instrument in a pioneer society.
So Larry Adler, did he understand his musical contribution as we look back a century since he really started this revolution?
I think so. You know, it's difficult to say. One never knows what people think at the end. When you play concertos with orchestras, you know, it's a very different world from the world that is pop music. There's a whole other world of music out there that's wonderful.
Well, it's great to be close to your brain, Robert Bonfiglio. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
Why don't you take us out with a tune? Robert Bonfiglio, harmonica player, friends with Larry Adler, born 100 years ago today. So if this Valentine's Day, on Friday, your date or outing or quiet evening at home with your partner starts to go something like this.
Magic flashed. Blazing sparks engulfed him in azure energy. The glowing outline of his big body grew even bigger, muscles bulging thicker, swelling along lengthening bones. Fingernails curved into claws, shredding the sheet he still gripped.
Whoa. Oh, now there's some Valentine's Day sparks, but perhaps better left on the page. That's right, on the page. The $1.4 billion pages of the romance novel genre industry. It's the hottest thing right now in publishing. Author Angela Knight, reading from her book Master of Darkness. She's actually big in the romance subgenre of paranormal erotic romance. You know, girl meets boy, boy turns into vampire, vampire fights with werewolf over girl, girl gets to decide whether to give in or say, uh-uh. It's all very dreamy.
He was actually dreaming about his heroine. In the dream, she was in danger. So that's the reason why he was turning into a werewolf, is that he wanted to protect her.
Angela Knight from Spartanburg, South Carolina, where she used to be a crime reporter. And all kinds of interesting details like that emerged when Jesse Barron, assistant editor at Harper's Magazine, attended the recent first annual romance novel convention in Las Vegas. Angela Knight was also there. Barron says this is a literary genre that makes no apologies to neither the Pulitzers or the Nobel Prizes.
The romance novel industry, first of all, it's really, really big. It's a $1.4 billion market. It's much bigger than literary fiction. It's bigger than anything. The types of novels that most people imagine, I think, when they think of romance are more old-fashioned novels, are Harlequin novels that, you know, your mom may have read. There used to be a subscription service where you'd get these novels. And that stuff still happens. That's the sort of really withholding heroes and the heroine who thaws him and maybe an arranged marriage leads to love. But what you're seeing a lot of now is much more explicitly erotic romance. 50 Shades would be the most famous example. But there's really a huge variety of stuff. And the romance has gotten much more sexual and much more comfortable with violence and with
handcuffs. Exactly. But Angela, years ago when I was with ABC News, I interviewed Anne Rice. And at the time, she was like the whole genre in some sense of this paranormal, leaning romantic fiction. How much of an influence is someone like Anne Rice in your life and writing?
Oh, huge. I was 17 or 18, I suppose, when I read Interview with a Vampire, which, of course, was her first vampire novel.
Yep.
And she's the one that really kicked off the build toward paranormal. Because up until then, of course, vampires books were written by men. And men always, almost always, write vampires as monsters. And women tend to write them as heroic or romantic characters a lot more.
Are you writing for women, by and large?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that is my audience. There are not that many male romance readers, and it's not written for them. Men have generally a different perception of sexuality and romance than women do because their brains are wired a little differently. So when men read romances and they hit the sex scenes and they hit the romance part of it, they're like, what is this? This makes no sense. Which is why romance has a rotten reputation, is because men don't get it.
You know, it's interesting. Women use their imagination in thinking broadly about sexuality. When men do the same thing, they sort of, Jesse, it seems like they end up kind of in a Howard Stern place, just sort of imagining doing the forbidden as opposed to something more wild and literary.
I think that's true. Angela's absolutely right when she says that there's not a male audience for romance. It's about 92-93% of the readers of romance who are women. But I do think that for men, I think a lot of the fantasies and sexual imagination that men have, as you say, is different. But a lot of it is close to things that are uncomfortable to think about, like power and control and violence. And romance is a sort of safe way for a lot of women, I think, to consider these issues that really do affect them.
Jesse, is the romance industry and the convention that you attended out in Las Vegas, yeah. I mean, what is the feel? Is it kind of, S&M / NERF, you know, everything sort of harmless but explicit?
The general feel when I was out there, especially for people at the top, is that there's a real comfort with sexuality, with, as you say, with not just, you know, handcuffs and stuff, but even much more subtle, more intense sexual arrangements like erotic contracts. And there is a comfort with that. I think it's one big thing that's changed since the bodice rippers were big in the 80s. In a bodice ripper, the logic of the sexual encounter is take me. And now there's a lot of novels like 50 Shades that are contract novels where the logic is I give myself to you. And it's a real shift in the sexual agency of heroines and romance.
So let me get that straight. So take me is the old style. That the new style is here's what we're going to do now and these are the rules and then we go wild.
Yeah.
Angela, you know, the worst review I ever read of a book was when the New York Review of Books, right, okay, can't get more stodgy than that, decided to review 50 Shades of Grey. They opened an AK-47 into that book. I mean, they truly, truly hated it in every way. With so much talk about the billion-dollar revenues and the sales and the audience and the numbers, is there a discussion of quality writing?
Absolutely. When I got published, it was very difficult to get published. You had to go through this whole years-long process of learning to write, learning the craft. Now you can go out, self-publish, without even bothering to get it so much as spell checked, and in theory at least start making money. And a lot of us who have really learned the craft and worked for years to get into this industry are really torqued about that because it makes people who encounter these books think that we all write like that. And we don't like that at all.
Is that what you saw in Vegas, Jesse? A difference, a sort of a split between the kind of schlocky newbies and the old guard? This is real romance. This is real writing.
Yeah, there's some schlocky newbies. There's probably some schlocky old guard writers too.
There are.
But I think that part of the thing that goes on, I think, with something like the NYRB 50 Shades review is that the things that we would use in New York in a sort of literary publication like the NYRB to review a book, those are a totally different set of criteria than what romance readers are using. So good romance prose is quick and immediate and casual, and it has a real celerity in the plotting, and you just get carried along. And it's just not the types of things that we're looking for when we – and when I say we, I mean in our little bubble. I work at Harper's in New York, and there's this little literary thing – and it's a different set of criteria that's used. So I think that's definitely part of it. Now, one of the reasons that romance is great on ebooks is that once you master this this type of writing, it's easier to produce a lot of books. A literary writer might need 5 years, but a romance writer can maybe do a couple books a year. And if you sell them cheaply and sell a lot of units, you can really make some money.
Reporting on the romance industry for us, Jesse Barron, who wrote Bad Romance, One Genre and a Billion Happy Endings for Harper's, where he is an editor. And thanks to author Angela Knight. Donna thanks all the romance authors. They give me a rest from the world that I live in, she writes. They make me laugh and cry. When I was going through a very difficult time in my life a few years ago, I reread every one of them. They allowed me to survive, and I will be forever grateful to them. Donna wrote us on Facebook. You can call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And we'll leave you romantically with Robert Bonfilio as we mark the 100th birthday of harmonica virtuoso Larry Adler. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.